collapse its army, government, and national morale, it launched a surprise attack that later came to be known as Blitzkrieg. In this way, Paris accepted unconditional defeat within 12 days and remained under the boots of the Nazi soldiers until the end of the war. The Zionist regime, using the name Blitzkrieg method, managed to win the battlefield in just 6 days in 1967. For this reason, in attacking Iran with the approval, coordination, and support of the White House, it chose the same method. But carrying out this operation, in addition to military and security preparations, also required other preliminaries similar to what Rafael Grossi carried out. According to the plan devised by America and Israel, Grossi was supposed to frighten Western public opinion with reports so that everything would be prepared for major war against Iran. That is exactly what happened. Rafael Grossi, betraying the legitimate and legal rights of the Iranian people while accusing the Islamic Republic of nuclear evasion and concealment, provided the groundwork and pretext for the aggression of the Israeli regime and the U.S. against Iran. The regime's next plot was Donald Trump's negotiation game. In this design, the White House, knowing that in the midst of negotiations, no one expects a full-scale battle, tried to lower the level of Iranian readiness to confront the aggression of the Israeli regime. Interestingly, to make the deception even greater, June 15th, just 2 days after Israel's attack, was set as a date for a new round of indirect negotiations between Iran and the United States, mediated by Oman.
قرار هست که دو طرف دیدگاه خودشون رو نسبت به این پیشنهادات و راهکارها ارائه بدن و بعد دور بعدی مذاکرات تنظیم بشه و
What's happening now to Syria, or what's happened to Syria over the past year and a half, is what the Israelis would like to do to Iran. They want to fracture their neighbors, break them apart if possible. So that's how you deal with Egypt and Jordan. And with countries like Syria, countries like Lebanon, countries like Iran, countries like Iraq, the basic goal there is to wreck those countries, to break them apart, to make them dysfunctional. And that's the second goal. That's the regime change goal when you dig down deep.
The Israeli regime's assessment was that, given Iran's chronic economic problems and social divisions, after a lightning military strike, spontaneous protest cells would emerge, and what happened in Syria would be repeated in Iran as well. Thus, it was that June 13th marked the beginning of a difficult time for Iranians. With the multi-layer hacking of the integrated air defense system and targeting of warning radars, the first challenge to the security of Iran's skies emerged. Within a short time, the path was opened for heavy air-launched projectiles to enter Iran's airspace so that, in the most severe manner possible, both the country's high-level military command structure would be destroyed through the assassination of commanders, and Iran's valuable assets in the nuclear and defense industries would be eliminated.
3:37
The commanders whom the Israeli regime assassinated at dawn on June 13th were the very ones who were supposed to direct the war. Commander Bagheri, Commander Rashid, Commander Salami, and Commander Hajizadeh. The scientists who were assassinated were Dr. Abbasi, Dr. Tehranchi, Dr. Ferhi, Dr. Zulfaghari, and Dr. Manoucher, all distinguished professors at Iran's top universities in nuclear fields. Assassination of nuclear scientists, like that of military commanders, was repeated several more times until the end of the war, and in total, during the 12-day imposed war, the Israeli regime robbed Iran's scientific community of 13 prominent nuclear professors. In the course of these assassinations of commanders and scientists, many innocent citizens living in their neighborhoods, as well as members of their families, were also martyred. According to the planners of this attack, with the assassination of high-ranking generals, the situation in Iran would become so chaotic that hired groups and counter-revolutionaries could seize control of parts of Tehran, such as Mehrabad Airport and its surrounding areas, from the police and security forces. This was deemed to cause the conditions through street chaos. Special forces would be airlifted into Iran, pushing the structure of Iran's government to the brink of collapse within a matter of days. Although the blows delivered at dawn on June 13th would have been enough to bring about the collapse of the governments of many powerful countries in the world, this did not happen in Iran. In the very first hours after the attack, the leader of the revolution, through a message, illuminated the path of resistance for the Iranian nation. Despite security threats, he maintained this line of communication with the people and officials throughout the 12 days of war, so that while directly managing the battle, the necessary measures could be taken based on the realities of the field. The presence of the commander-in-chief during the 12-day war once again proved his role in restoring psychological calm to society and preserving the cohesion and organization of the armed forces in defending the country. The peak of this unique role was in appointing senior military commanders as replacements for the martyrs who had been assassinated by the Israeli regime. On the afternoon of the first day of the war, the leader of the Islamic Revolution once again addressed the people in a televised message. In the past, it had been proven many times that Iran, through its missile industry, possesses both the capability and the will to punish its enemies, especially the Israeli regime. For this reason, Iran's missile response was the most predictable action of the Islamic Republic, and naturally, Israel had devised what it thought were countermeasures for it. According to their plan, in the very first moments of June 13th, the commanders and missile bases of the IRGC were supposed to come under fire. With extensive propaganda and the wide circulation of images showing the destruction of missile launchers on June 13th, many were led to believe that Iran no longer had the ability to respond with missiles. The launch of dozens of older generation IRGC drones before noon that same day could also have made these illusions seem real. But shortly afterward, following the televised message of the leader of the revolution to the people, the first wave of Iranian missile launches began, plunging the West into an intelligence shock. The name of this operation had already been determined: True Promise 3. In line with operations True Promise 1 and 2, the IRGC in its first missile response did exactly what the regime had anticipated. using a large number of missiles so that the Israelis would feel assured that Iran's missile response pattern had not changed. The Israeli army assumed that by Iran's numerous launches, the locations of its missile systems would be exposed and subsequently, under aerial strikes, another portion of the Islamic Republic's missile capability could be destroyed.
Country in the world that believes that when they just go out and start bombing civilians, that that's called self-defense. It's absurd. So Iran didn't waste any time. They have retaliated within about less than 24 hours, and they've hit Israel and Tel Aviv and other sites throughout Israel. The Israeli government's going to great lengths to cover that up and pretend, oh, nothing happened here.
Israel suffered massive losses, many direct hits in Haifa, in Beersheba, in Tel Aviv, the Iron Dome, and the other parts of the system, because that's just one component of Israel's air defense system, failed on multiple occasions. Iran has missiles that can penetrate Israel's air defenses.
A large number of missiles, drones, and ballistic and cruise missiles launched in Iran's first response was observed. The armed forces of the Islamic Republic updated their information on the regime's defensive layers. After that, contrary to the enemy's expectations, the number of missiles decreased. This was the second stage of deceiving the Israeli army, because the other side assumed that the missile stockpiles of the Islamic Republic of Iran had been severely reduced. Now, it was time to carry out the next stage of Iran's new missile tactics. At this stage, while launching small waves of missiles at different times, the number of operations increased. Gradually, unlike the hours of night and darkness, launches were carried out during the day and under the bright sky, the very sky over which the Zionists and America claim to have dominance.
How badly was the Israeli defense industry in Israel damaged by the retaliation from the Iranian missiles? Do we know?
No, we don't have any details. There's no question that a number of sites were hit. Air bases were hit. Research institutions were hit. They ran out of running out of defensive missiles, as we know. So damage was done. And of course, damage was done to all sorts of buildings, both military buildings and civilian buildings inside of Tel Aviv. And then in Haifa, they hit the port. They did enormous damage to the one of the two oil refineries that the Israelis have. So they did, the Iranians did an enormous amount of damage inside of Israel. But
Israel thought, A, that this war would be short and quick. They thought they had the decapitation strike in place. Shock and awe would collapse the regime. That didn't work. They were hoping that their ballistic missile defense shield, together with American assistance, would be able to prevent significant damage being done to Israel. They're wrong.
The variety of launch systems used each time surprised the other side even more than before. The launches were a combination of old and new generation missiles, the product of years of tireless effort by martyrs such as Tehrani Mogaddem and Haji Zadeh. This abundant, large-scale, and diverse legacy was employed each time with a different arrangement and type, resulting in the defensive systems of the regime being worn down after repeated engagements. simultaneous use of old and new missiles significantly increased the chances of hitting targets. As a result, the armed forces were able to successfully strike vital targets such as the Weizmann Research Center, intelligence and security facilities, the Rafael military complex, the Haifa refinery, airports and military bases, strategic industrial installations, and dozens of other targets in 22 waves of missile attacks.
Yeah, mashallah. How you say it this morning?
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. السلام علیکم to all of you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Youth Station. This is Nahid having the honor of being with you, and here with me I have the pleasure of being with my very dear sister
Masuma. How are you?
Great. How about you?
Everything is nice. Let us say I have talked bad about you behind you to one of our common friends, and then you realize about it. What would be your reaction when you see me?
Well, if it was a few years ago, I would have reacted harshly. Like, mm-hmm. I would have, forgot you. I would have tried to run away from the places that I would meet you even.
Oh.
I mean, remove that person, not you.
Ghost me?
Yeah, not you. God forbidden. That person. I would have deleted her from my social contacts from everywhere. Like,
oh.
As if I even don't know them. Right now, I remember some friends that they had. Even I don't have their number. Like, once we had a kind of a problem at work, and then that person was kind of backbiting and was sad at us and all these stuff. A few months after that, one of my friends said, have you seen those kinds of words that she is just posting on social media? And on the accounts that she knew that we were supposedly going to be there to watch. And I said, no. She said, how not? Why haven't you seen them? I was like, oh, I removed her number, so I don't have her number, so I didn't have access to her social media on WhatsApp or whatever application, so I haven't seen.
So you removed
this
her.
Much, that I even didn't have the number, so I couldn't see what she's saying.
So you totally removed her,
yeah.
Blocked her,
yeah.
Physically, emotionally, mentally,
yeah.
And socially.
But now, I'm more mature. I mean, mm-hmm. I've learned more lessons, and I know how to react a bit in a more political, strategic way. But what about you? What if the same thing would happen to you? How would you react?
Of course, it depends on so many things, what has been said, to whom it has been said, and how close that friend was. So let's imagine the worst. Let's imagine that loveliest friend of mine that I really love, and she understands me, I understand her, we've been girlies and amazing.
Yeah.
If she says something bad, since I know her, and I know her lovely soul, I will not get angry at that moment. I will, but I will try to control it because first of all, I respect the years and the time we have been together. Secondly, I don't know the whole story yet. And I have learned this lesson that for me, at least, it works better to speak.
So you're patient.
I am not. I'm working on it.
Oh, very good.
I thought I was patient until I realized I'm not. So now I'm working on it. I'm going to talk to her. For me, that would work better because she's a close friend, and it's not just removable friend.
So as for your response, you would have gone and talked to her?
Yes, for this specific important friend.
Would you tell her the exact thing that you heard?
I would be honest.
You heard this, so is it true or not?
I will be honest with her. I will be like, I heard this, that you said this. What's the story? And I'm sure if we would talk, she would have a good explanation, and since we both are honest, as far as I know now, we're going to be able to solve the problem. But if it's not a very important friend, maybe it's just a colleague that we counted each other as friend, you know, like the very beginning level of friendship, when then I would, you know, keep my distance.
So that is
to protect myself.
Nice strategy.
Yes, it highly depends on the person, because you cannot have one size doesn't fit all. Come on. I cannot have one rule for everything.
It's also the improvement. I mean, this world has taught us different ways. Maybe in the past, everyone would have gone for a kind of fight or a struggle.
Yes, yes.
But these days, people are changing. They are learning the calm ways of confrontation.
Yes.
They talk to each other, which is very nice. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that there are many difficulties rooted in this calm confrontation. I mean, as for me, I said I'm changing my strategies, but it is hard for me. It's hard to see that same person again and again. It's hard for me to be the same.
It is.
And this makes it difficult, makes it challenging. So let's devote today's episode on talking about the different ways to respond on these situations. On the occasion that you know that your close friend, I don't know, a relative, a family member, has said something that would make you sad.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back to Youth Station. We're talking about how we would respond if someone has talked bad about us.
Yeah.
Behind us, very importantly.
Well, the first strategy for many people is deleting that person.
Mm-hmm.
But it depends. I mean, it has different layers as for
yes.
me. As I said, I've changed these days. And what I meant is this, that up today, if the same thing happens to me, first, I would not think about it. I mean, as a supervisor, sometimes I get harsh criticism, harsh messages or comments from the teachers that are complaining. Even some of them are so young. And I know that she or he doesn't mean the thing that they're saying. So I get some messages, but the first thing that these days I do, in the past I used to just read them and then, okay, you were rude. Rude people are not in my circle, fired. I used to be like this. But these days I changed in this way that I don't check my messages. I don't see them. I don't try to think about them. If I heard something, I will not think about it for a while. Like maybe 2 or 3 days, I will not check the message. I will not answer. I will not talk to that person. So that my mind is in a more comfortable mood, then I go for a decision.
Oh, so you're managing your emotions.
Yeah, in this way, that I postpone. I delay my answer to some time so I can just focus better.
That's very interesting, actually. I think that would work very good in work life because, deleting people, removing people from our life, blocking them was an easy option when we were high school students.
Yeah.
But now, well, we are in a bigger world, we're in a bigger society, and just ditching people is not an option for everyone. As you mentioned, they're your colleagues. They can be, and the worst situation can be their family.
Yeah.
Imagine one of your close family members, maybe your sister, oh my God, like, this is possible. Now that I'm saying it, I cannot imagine it because my sister is such a sweet little girl. She's younger than me, so I will always see her like this little
baby. You're a supportive person.
Yes, this is little baby of mine. So if she ever talks bad about me and then I realize, of course it's going to break me. It's going to hurt me. But I cannot remove her. We are together. Even if we're living in separate houses, we are still connected. So it can be really hard. Yeah. And I'll stick to my still same strategy of communication. Communication is the key for me. I would talk to them because these kind of relationships are important. Close friends, families. We have invested so much time, bond, and emotions in it that it needs a good communication. But for example, if such thing would happen for me in work, then yes, I would use your method. That's nice.
Yeah.
I would wait for a bit better, cold mind, not hot, angry mind. And then I would try to solve
the problem. Yeah, and it's so important that we know that it's in our nature that we would like to react harshly.
Yes.
I mean, it's part of my nature as a human being that the moment that I see some negative ideas, I would like to attack. I would like to, react in a harsh way. So once I realize that, okay, it's normal, but let's control it.
Yes.
Maybe during the day you see lots of people, you would like to punch them in the face, but then you control yourself.
Yes, we do. And you also mentioned a part just a few sentences ago that you'd understand them when you mention that they're young and you understand them. That is also very nice that we need to understand them. What made him or her say that? Are they mature even yet or not? What did they mean? Maybe they meant something else. And this person who's coming and telling me that person A has talked, is even this person trustable or not? What is this person looking after? Is this person, trying to make our relationship get screwed or what?
Yeah, even is my close friend at that moment okay? Maybe she was so pressurized. Maybe I did something before that made her this overwhelmed that she wanted to react or say these stuff. And the other thing that, Massimo, there's a lesson I learned from one of my colleagues. He's a psychologist.
Yes.
And a few years ago, those first years that I was at work, as I told you, I was so young. So once we had a kind of argument, I wouldn't have just waited for it to be over. And I would fire that person, that teacher, say, from the institute because of the reason that she or he was rude, for example. Then one day he came to me. He's my friend's husband. He's a kind of, say, a friendly person who would like to change everything to a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
And then he told me this, and this really changed my mindset. He said, okay, imagine that you've done this for all people around you, everyone who was rude, everyone who was not following your criteria and your rule. Then are you going to bear everything together all alone?
Mm-hmm.
And are you supporting yourself, your character, as an educated person? Or when you are doing so, you are just taking revenge? Sometimes, knowingly or unknowingly, we are just supporting our ego. We are not going for protecting our soul.
Yes.
This is very important, knowing that the way we react sometimes is rooted in the ego. I want to keep my position. I want to tell everyone that I have this position and I'm proud of it. So because of this, once a person is standing in front of me, I will remove them.
Oh.
So this makes it even ugly, makes it
ruder
than the thing that person has done.
Because now you're aware of what's going deep inside you.
Yeah, exactly. So sometimes we human beings, we are just protecting our ego. We are highlighting our ego. And we forget about our soul. Our soul as a human being should look at each other as sisters, as even regarding the younger people, like our younger siblings, once we look at them in a motherhood way, in a way that I'm going to be supportive for them, I'm going to help them improve. So in this way, we would not have done those things. We would not have gone for those reactions.
That's really interesting. So you mean that we might also want to change ourselves? And see the point that they want. Yeah, not to feel hurt and, pull a guard, but to think outside your body.
And this is more on our side, not the side of that person who has done a mistake, be it whatever thing they have done. Here we are thinking about ourselves, the way I am behaving and the effect I am having on this problem. Am I worsening it or am I just solving it?
And it's really interesting that whatever strategy that we're using, as your friend mentioned, that we need to think about it, that what will be the outcome in me and around me in long term.
Exactly.
If I keep having this strategy for long term, Will I have any people left around me? Will I be able to make a better, you know, communication with my society?
And can I handle my life?
Yes, that's very interesting.
So this is very important that once we want to think about the ways to react, we have to go inside as well. Think of ourselves after the problem. I mean, okay, now my friend has done a mistake. What if a few days later, after my reaction, I will be the bad person in this story? Mm-hmm. The way I acted makes it worse. So this is also important. The other thing is that we can just set boundaries. I mean, we can use our trust, as you said in the story of your friend, we can use our trust, this trust between us, to rebuild our relationship slowly. Maybe we get hurt at the moment, but once we talked, once we go back and we feel like, oh, I trust this person. Mm-hmm. So maybe what they have said was not like this. Maybe they didn't mean this way. So this can also help. And regarding our religion, our great prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam had said, backbiting is worse than adultery. So backbiting is one of the kinds of sins that is never accepted. But also in this situation, the person who is telling us this story is the one to be blamed.
Yes, of course, as I already mentioned.
And we are being part of it.
We need to also encounter that. What is this person looking for? What was its aim? Was it really for my sake?
Most of the times, no.
What are they up to? In simple words, what are you up to? Why are you telling me? Okay, someone said something. Someone did bad to me and I have no idea. What are you up to by telling me? Are you really trying to save me? Or did you even, you know, talk back to her? Did you defend me or not? You know, this has this topic. However, it seems very simple, yet it is very complicated. It is very complicated because it has different aspects and layers to it. Was I really wrong? Why was the one who is backbiting really backbiting? Why is this listener coming and telling me? And what should I do? All these layers really make everything complicated. But I'm sure with just, you know, having some healthy boundaries and being nice toward ourselves and others, true. We can solve the problem.
Yeah, we are the modern citizens of the world. Yes. We say we are equipped with everything and technology mm-hmm. and all the lessons and all the books and stuff. So we have to act like one.
Yes.
So next time that you heard something of a friend that you really love or a family member, relative, whoever, and you felt like you have to react harshly, wait for a second, think, and then decide, are you going to go mm-hmm. for revenge? Are you going to forgive? And what strategy you, as a Muslim, are going to choose, which is not going to be the place that you regret. With all these great wishes, we end today's episode. Wassalamu alaikum
wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you dear youth will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings. Be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Reactions are pouring in after Israeli forces carried out a deadly incursion into a Damascus suburb, killing at least 13 people, including children. Syria's foreign ministry condemned the attack as a brutal massacre, saying Israeli forces resorted to indiscriminate shelling after failing to advance on the ground. The ministry held Israel fully responsible, warning that its continued attacks threaten regional stability. Palestinian resistance groups also condemned the strike, saying the incursion shows Israel poses a threat to the wider region. Qatar also denounced the attack as a blatant violation of Syrian sovereignty and international law. On Friday, Israeli forces raided the Syrian town of Beit Jinn before launching artillery and missile strikes, leaving multiple people dead. We'll be discussing the Israeli violations and much more on tonight's edition of Spotlight with our guests. Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University, Saad Nimr, who's with us from Ramallah. And we also have security and political analyst Mr. Ali Risk joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Professor Nimr. Can you break down for us, please, what is happening in Syria as the Israelis are repeatedly and casually encroaching on another Arab country's territorial integrity?
Well, I believe that this is exactly what we have to understand, that Israel is going to do this again and again in all of the region, not only in Syria, but in Lebanon, and they are doing that also in Gaza in spite of the ceasefire. It's the idea that Israel wanted to put forward their own ideas about how they are going to treat or to deal with the area from the upper hand of the Israelis, and that they can do whatever they want at any time they want. What happened today when they went to arrest some people from the suburb of Damascus, they faced the people themselves. It's not the army, it's not the regime in Syria, it was the people of the village, because they can't accept the idea of the occupation and what the occupation is doing, since they are occupying this part of Syria, and they resist the Israeli force and causing them heavy casualties. Three in critical conditions and three were injured. Well, that was surprising for the Israelis. That's what matters. Now in Israel, they are discussing this issue, whether there was lack of information, whether that was a mistake, a tactical mistake, but they are really annoyed with that. And that's why they sent back the Air Force and the artillery to shell this village, causing more than 13 of murders in this village. The idea here that Israel wanted to set a kind of a format for the region, that we can do whatever we want. And if we return back to what Netanyahu said about the peace, which now Lebanon is talking about, negotiations with Israel, and also in Syria, they are talking about negotiations with Israel. Netanyahu said, only with Israeli strong army we can impose the peace that we want. This kind of peace that he wanted, the peace that you have to comply directly to what the Israeli wanted, otherwise they will continue to bombard here and there and to have atrocities against these countries and these regions unless you comply exactly with what the Israeli wanted. This is this kind of peace that they are thinking of. So I think that's for the whole region and for all the Arab and Islamic countries to understand that you can't deal with this kind of entity. This regime, a fascist regime, it's not going to make peace in the region. To the contrary, they wanted to control the whole area, and this is their aim, and it's quite obvious in all these incidents that is happening, whether in Gaza or in Lebanon or even in Syria now.
Okay, let's bring in Mr. Risk from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Ali Risk, weigh in on the events for us, please. And also another matter that has become even more clear than before is that Israel can attack where and when it wants. Clear actions of an international pariah and rogue regime. However, there's no accountability for these actions. How worrying and dangerous is this level of impunity for the region?
Well, that's nothing new. Ever since October 7, the Israelis have begun to behave as if they have the right to do as they wish, as if they're above international law, under this pretext of what happened again on October 7. So this is kind of a new Israeli strategy, and they have full American backing up until now regarding that strategy. But I'm not sure how wise the Israelis are being when it comes to Syria, because you have the new Syrian figures in power led by Ahmad al-Shara. They've been extending a hand to Israel for quite some time. And that's being met only with more Israeli aggressions, more Israeli occupation, more Israeli escalation. So in my humble opinion, the Israelis are actually committing a fatal mistake. They have there's a neighboring country there which is offering to be their ally, and they're actually, if they continue to do this, they're transforming that potential ally into an enemy. So I don't believe that speaks very well to the Israeli strategic thinking, and I think it just goes to show that the Israelis are pursuing hegemony at all costs, and I think if you can even more accurately describe it as being irrational hegemonic policy, which won't be good for the Israelis in the long term. And this has contributed to the emergence of a resistance. It appears that a resistance against Israel is in the works in Syria. Incidentally, this incident took place after Netanyahu and some senior Israeli figures visited. They took actually a tour in Syrian territory. So I think it's important to link it to that there are many in Syria, notwithstanding the gestures which are being made by Ashara and by his government, there are many in Syria who are on a completely different page and refuse to allow Israel to do as it wishes and to behave in this way in Syria. So again, I don't think that the general Israeli approach towards Syria is a very wise approach, and what happened in Beijing, I believe, is evidence of that.
Sure. Professor Nimr, on that issue, we've seen the reactions from the HTS-led government. Many have criticized it, actually, for being insufficient. There's Syrian human rights activists criticizing the HTS-led government in Damascus for its failure to stop the Israeli regime's crimes since day one. Why this silence and lackluster reactions to the Israelis' attacks and crimes that they've been carrying out against Syria since day one?
The first thing that the Syrians are not intending anyway to have a kind of a conflict with the Israeli. From day one, they were talking about, you know, that they are willing to have peace with Israel, and they are willing to be part of, you know, whatever is prepared for the region by the Americans. And they showed a kind of, you know, a full cooperation with Israel. But the Israeli are not doing that because they have their own conditions which Syria can't accept. This is one issue. The other issue, Syria unable to face Israel at this moment for many reasons. First of all, it's very new regime, around 1 year now. And at the same time, remember that after the collapse of the previous regime, immediately Israel destroyed around 85% of the capability of the Syrian army, whether it's in the tanks and airplanes and the artillery and all things. So now I don't think that Syria in a position to stand against Israel as we talk in a kind of a war or in a kind of an aggression against aggression, but they can do something else. To clear that they are going out of any kind of cooperation, and they can allow, and they will say that if you are occupying our country, so definitely there will be resistance. So try to at least do these kind of things in order to pressurize the Israeli, because on the other hand, they can't do anything else, nothing else. It's only the diplomatic kind of way in order to stop Israel. And that's why we have the foreign ministry statement today, which is condemning and holding Israel responsibility. So what? So what? This is definitely not enough. And they should do something, especially with the Americans, that now they are, you know, having this kind of relationship with the American. This will affect the American interest in the region. I think that they should now understand that they should apply some pressure on the Americans. It's not only the Syrians. I'm talking about all the Arabs. Why they are, you know, not even thinking about that. That's exactly also the same situation in Lebanon. In Lebanon, the President Aoun, he just delivered the speech and he said that we are willing to negotiate with the Israeli and to start the negotiations to cease fire permanently and to take out the Israeli out of Lebanon, the withdrawal and disarmament of Hezbollah. The answer came 2 days later, immediately by the Israeli, by targeting Beirut and Har Tahrir in Beirut. That was an assassinating, you know, Tabtabai. This is quite obvious that this is the answer of Israel. They are not willing to negotiate with any Arab country unless they are totally comply with what the Israeli wanted and they are under the order of Israel. That's the kind of negotiation that the Israeli understand now. And this is what Netanyahu talked about is the new Middle East that he's looking for. These countries supposed to submit to the Israeli will.
Abi Risk, Syrians are also not happy with the violation of their sovereignty by the Israeli regime. Protests have been held across Syria following Friday prayers in condemnation of the latest Israeli crimes in the Damascus suburbs. Do you think that this will also lead to rising opposition across Syria to the HTS-led government for their attitude that they've shown towards the Israelis and for their lack of action as well?
I think it will, the more the Israelis continue with this escalation. I think that will put more pressure, more popular pressure on the Ashara regime. I think that this, in the end, it'll put pressure in terms of Ashara's efforts to try and reach. As I said before, he's been making gesture after gesture towards Israel, and that's been met only with more Israeli escalation, which exposes Ashara to be rather humiliated. So I think that the pressure is going to pile up, and this may lead Ashara to somewhat take a different kind of course, not being so conciliatory towards the Israelis, particularly when Ashara, before his previous name, Al-Julani, meaning the Golan Heights, he had spoken about liberating the Golan Heights, etc. He's taking a completely opposite approach. So I think it is bound, if it continues, if the Israeli escalation continues leading to more popular pressure on Ashara, I think it's bound to lead to some kind of change. And again, this brings me back. Israel is isolating itself in the region. But you have to remember, I think, at the same time, what Israel's objectives are. One of the main motivators for Israel's escalation in Syria is to prevent the strengthening of Turkey. Now, we all know that Ashara is very close to Turkey, and what the Israelis are saying now is that having Ashara strong in Syria means having strong Turkish influence, and Turkey is seen as a competitor for Israel in terms of regional domination, being a major regional heavyweight. So a lot of Netanyahu's calculations stem from that perspective. So the Israelis are turning potential friends into potential enemies, but it's part of a broader project to establish undisputed Israeli hegemony, whereby they want to eliminate any Iranian competition, any Turkish competition, to be the undisputed hegemon. Now, I think the guest mentioned the issue of the United States. This is where I believe that there might be differences between the U.S. and Israel. When it comes to fighting Iran, I think that the Israelis and the Americans are on the same page. But when it comes to countering Turkey, I don't think that the Israelis and Americans are on the same page. Israel wants to establish hegemony, complete hegemony, including by diminishing any Turkish role, any Turkish influence. But the United States considers Turkey to be a partner in the region. The problem is that, as I've argued many times, is that the Americans are more in sync with the Israeli policy, or in other words, the Israelis often succeed in dragging the U.S. in the way they want in terms of regional policy. Will they succeed again in doing this now in Syria? I think only time will tell after this incident.
Very well. Professor Nimrod, the Israeli Prime Minister, is attacking Syria out of desperation for a political and military victory after repeated failures. Do you agree with that notion?
To a certain degree, yes, because now remember that Israel is approaching also the elections, and some part of the actions by the Israelis, whether in Gaza or in Lebanon or in Syria now, it's also part of the campaign for the next elections. He wanted to say that we are still involved in security, and now Israel, I am, as Netanyahu, the king, as his followers would like to call him, is the one who could deliver the security for Israel and the domination over the area and to put down any potential danger on Israel by Arab countries. So this is the what Netanyahu is thinking of now, and especially that they are approaching the elections by next year, or you know, like few months, if you like. Because of that, this is one of the things that in the mind of Netanyahu. But there are also lots of criticism inside Israel today, especially after they woke up in what was going on, and even the opposition in Israel are talking about this operation as a part of, you know, kind of Netanyahu wanted to show off some kind of operations here and there in order to have more of supporters during the elections. So this is, you know, one of the things which is Netanyahu is focusing on. And I do agree with Ali totally that Israel is doing really very harm to themselves on the long run by you know, bringing in more and more enemies. And especially now we are talking about the people, and that what was really very, you know, important for the Israelis, that it's not the army, it's not the regime, it was the people of the village of Beit Jan who started this kind of resistance against the Israelis. So if that's going to be repeated everywhere, so they are opening a new kind of a front for the Israelis. And the Israelis are now talking about, is that necessary in this moment to open a new front or not? So this is really put Israel in a very awkward situation.
Ali Rizk, there was this theory since day one when, as you phrased it, these new figures in Syria came to power, that the HTS has been tasked with the Balkanization of Syria. I want to get your thoughts on that viewpoint. And if that's the case, who benefits the most from this breakup of Syria?
I'm not sure about that theory, that HTS has been cast with the mission, or tasked, sorry, with the mission of dividing or fragmenting Syria. Remember, again, Ashara, his closest ally, arguably his closest ally, is Turkey. Turkey doesn't want the Balkanization of Syria. That would give the Kurds semi-independence. That's the last thing Turkey wants. So I would be a bit hesitant to buy into this argument that somehow HTS has come in order to Balkanize Syria. I do think that Israel wants that. That would serve Israel very well to have an Alawite, then a Sunni, then a Kurdish statelet, particularly when the Israelis are talking about having a Jewish state. Ultimately, what the Israelis want, in my humble opinion, in Syria, is for there to be a failed state. And they want the same thing in Lebanon, by the way. They want it in all surrounding countries. Because when you have a failed state, that's the perfect pretext to further expand territorially. Under the pretext that failed states pose a threat because of the chaos, so then we must expand our borders. That, I think, is the Israeli strategy. And again, this strategy collides with the strategies of other players who are American allies. Again, I refer to Turkey. So no, I don't think that somehow Ashara has been tasked by those who support him to Balkanize Syria, Turkey and others, but I do think that that is the Israeli goal.
Professor Nim, how has the silence of Arab and Islamic nations emboldened Israel to press ahead with its illegal actions in Syria? You addressed that a little earlier. I want you to elaborate on that for us as well.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The Arab and Islamic countries, they do have the power not to pressurize Israel directly, but to pressurize the Americans. The Americans got their approval in whatever they are doing in the area, and they are, you know, very happy with that. And especially when Trump put his forward his 20 points plan for Gaza to cease fire, that was approved by Arab and Islamic countries. They also affected even the United Nations resolution on the same way when Russia and China have another suggestion, but the Arab and Islamic countries, they said that we are agreeing to that, so why you are objecting? So it's obvious that they have the ability to pressurize the Americans. Americans do know that they have interest in the region, and especially Arab countries of the Gulf states. The Americans knows that their interest there should not be contradicted with what Israel wanted if that come to the end of it. So I think they have the power to pressurize the Americans if they wanted to do so. The question is, are they willing to do so or not? I don't think that they are willing to do it, and they are not much interested on one hand. On the other hand, most of them are complying with what the Israeli wanted in this respect. So because of that, they are not, you know, playing any role to prevent Israel of doing what they are doing in the region. For God's sake, you know, they bombarded even Qatar, which is, you know, considered one of the biggest allies to the Americans and the biggest base for the Americans in the region. And still they got away with it. So the Arab and Islamic countries are not doing any role in order to prevent Israel of doing that, though they have the ability to do it, but they don't have the will to do it.
Ali Risco, final question to you. Many countries and groups have weighed in with their condemnations, but the likes of the U.S. and EU have not with regards to this recent attack on the village of Beit Jinn. How do you view the inconsistency from these Western capitals and also the silence of their mainstream media outlets regarding Israeli actions in Syria? I'm not even sure if we can call it inconsistency anymore, because in these matters, they seem to be consistently inconsistent.
Well, I'm quite sure that the West, Europe, and the United States are basically bought into this argument which the Israelis are saying, that this was an anti-terrorist operation. According to Israeli media, the operation was to arrest three members of Al-Jama'a Al-Islamiyya. And after that arrest took place, then they opened fire, that group. Al-Jama'a Al-Islamiyya is a Lebanese-based group, by the way. It's the Lebanese affiliate of the Muslim Brotherhood. And what's interesting here is that just a few days ago, the Trump administration designated certain branches of the Muslim Brotherhood as terrorist organizations. If I'm not mistaken, Al-Jama'a Al-Islamiyya is one of them, which was designated as a terrorist organization. So the West is going to see this, I think, through the lens, or portray it through the lens of an anti-terrorist operation, more than being any kind of violation of sovereignty or any kind of aggression against another country, despite the fact, and this is important, despite the fact that the Americans have invested quite a lot in Ashara. I mean, Trump welcomed him to the White House. It wasn't the usual meeting. He was forced to go through a side door. But nevertheless, that was a big investment, especially when someone who used to be with Al-Qaeda, maybe he still is, I don't know, and Al-Qaeda was responsible for September 11. So the U.S. was willing to put all that aside and welcome Al-Shara. Of course, the main aim for them, for the Trump administration, is because Al-Shara up until now was anti-Iran, and anything anti-Iran for the Trump administration is considered to be a blessing or something positive. So that's the approach which the West takes, again, which is not necessarily consistent with American interests. I don't think it's in American interests to have a Shara weaken, which would weaken Turkey and influence badly the partnership between Turkey and the US. The US, if it wants to preserve interest in this region, it can't be only supporting Israel whilst being the enemy of all the rest of the Arab countries. It's true what your guest said, that Arab countries haven't spoken up, but I think in the end they will be forced to speak up. And the question remains, is America willing to sacrifice all of his interests for the sake of the most fascist Israeli government? That remains to be seen.
All right, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests, Professor Saad Nimr, joining us from Ramallah. Also thanks to security and political analyst Ali Risk, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And, of course, a special thanks to you all for staying with us on tonight's edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.